Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu,
with a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
Today our scripture is the parable of the 10 bridesmaids. It's Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like this. 10 bridesmaids took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish, and 5 were wise. When the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, all of them became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a shout, "Look, here is the bridegroom. Come out to meet him." Then all those bridesmaids got up and trimmed their lamps. The foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise replied, "No, there will not be enough for you and for us. You had better go to the dealers and buy some for yourselves." And while they went to buy it, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went with him into the wedding banquet. And the door was shut. Later, the other bridesmaids came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he replied, "Truly I tell you, I do not know you. Keep awake, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour."
The world is burning as you're standing by. Are you watching as your children die? Did your heart break? Does your heart break now?
I'm going to talk some about this parable of the bridesmaids, but first I want to say a little bit of background just about how it is that it comes that we study the Bible. You know, Jesus was a teacher, and the church came out of a culture of the Jewish synagogue. And the Jewish synagogue was as much like a school as it was a place of worship. So what I mean by that is this room pretty much feels mostly like a place of worship. But the synagogue had a feeling of both and. And it was different than it is for us today. So I want to say that because it's important for us to remember that the earliest form of Sunday school is probably what you're learning right now, the way we are working with these parables. And the earliest form of Sunday school that came over to us in this country really was from churches wanting to teach people how to read because schools weren't in full, you know, like they are now. And so churches were helping communities in the frontiers and in all these new places. People of faith were helping people learn how to read, right? Why would a church want to teach people how to read? Read the Bible. Exactly. Can you imagine a frontier child of 6 figuring this stuff out? It's hard enough for us, right? It's hard enough for us. Especially if we're trying to understand and be certain about things. But that's how it comes to us, from the Jewish synagogue and teaching people back in that day, across these many generations, across the pond to America, into schools where churches try and teach people to read so they can read the Bible so we can try and understand and we can learn about things like the parables. But even if you were or are the best reader that you know, reading and comprehending are two different things, right? I don't know if you're at all like me. Maybe some of you are. I can read 3 pages and go, what? I know I read every word, but I have no idea what I just read. I can even do it out loud. I can read it out loud. So I have to sit there and go, okay, think, Linda, think. Make these words mean something. So I'm going to try and make these words somehow mean something, because we're journeying with some of these parables of Jesus, and we're trying to give up what we think we know for certain so that we might continue to grow in faith and not just tuck, you know, like bullet points of Jesus away and then whip them out when you get in an argument with someone. Easier said than done, I know. So this parable of the 10 bridesmaids, it's considered by Capon, and this is the book that we're using. It's really big and thick, but it's very readable, I promise. Kingdom, Grace, and Judgment. And I leave it up here. Some of you came and took pictures of it last week and have ordered it on Amazon. He talks about it as a parable of judgment. And so a parable that is under the framework of judgment, as opposed to grace, say, gives the ultimate lie to any view of faith as being certain. So that, I just want to have that umbrella for us this morning. And the parable of the 10 bridesmaids is considered a parable of judgment. So in order to understand what is meant by judgment, because already I know people have got their backs up. That's who we are. Judgment in this room. Uh-oh. Right? So just stay with me. Trust me, trust me. First, we have to acknowledge something. There's a biblical view of history in general that comes at play when we're using the word judgment in here. And judgment in this way is connecting us to people who are living long ago, and they're waiting, they're living in wait for the Messiah to come and save them out of the oppression in which they live. And current thought at the time was that this was going to be a really dramatic event. It was really going to happen in their lifetime. And like Sarah shared with us in her sermon last week, if you were here, or you can listen on the podcast, it was going to be a cataclysmic event with a huge separation, where the good folks would go one way and the bad folks another. It was very certain. Good folks to heaven, bad folks not to heaven. And I really don't think that could be further from the truth. But that was a mindset. Today, this parable is going to come to us about judgment in the setting of a wedding, all right? It was a wedding. A wedding is an event that everyone would have been familiar with. Events, as we often know, have a beginning, a middle, and an end, right? Like history does, like our lives do. We're born, we live, we die. Beginning, middle, end. And we like to think of life as stretching on indefinitely. I don't really like to think of that end thing, but we know it doesn't. Up here, we know it doesn't. We don't always live that way, but we know it doesn't. It's like history. There's a sense that this wedding is not going to go on forever. So, the groom, though, is late. That's what we're hearing about. The groom is late. The wedding banquet is happening, and the groom hasn't shown up. Why is that important? Well, Matthew's presenting this parable in a wedding setting so that we can understand that somewhere, somehow, something's got to happen. It's not just a no-happen zone, which is why if something's going to happen, there's going to be a judgment moment. And knowing that judgment is coming, it doesn't allow you the luxury of a historical perspective in which a step taken too soon or a move too late can always be taken back or remedied the next time around, because there may not be a next time around. That's what he's trying to get us to start thinking. Rather, a parable that's a parable of judgment is about a world in which, if you're too early or you're too late, that can be a crashing, fatal mistake for you. Because that's a world in which there is only one chance for anything. And we don't really like to think about that. And in the 10 bridesmaids, the bridegroom coming late, the oil of the foolish bridesmaids has run out, and the storekeeper's shops are all closed, and the door to the marriage feast is shut. And so just as history, as I said, had a beginning, middle, and an end, with a series of unrepeatable happenings, so too is the history of God and being saved with God. It'll happen, and you can't really go backwards. So a parable of judgment gives the ultimate lie to a view of faith as being completely certain about anything, really. Because it exposes maybe our desire, maybe, to have a static, immovable truth. It exposes that. Because what God saves by grace through faith is precisely the dynamic of history. I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm going to keep going and keep trying. Because the once and never again quality of a world that God was pleased to create anyway is just like that. Is like being saved only by grace, which you never know when it's going to come up. I hope that makes a little bit of sense. So here I'm going to go slower now, because that's the arcing view. And I'm going to go into each piece as I can. So we're going to work on this and start with this phrase that I said a few weeks ago. Remember, what you see is not always what you see in a parable. And what you hear is not always what you hear either. I know, it's so annoying. Most scholars agree that this parable is really intended to upfront be taken as an allegory. That is, each major element in the parable is a symbol for something else. And Matthew's readers at the time, or hearers, are supposedly able to crack that code way better than us, right? We are far removed from Matthew's time and setting, so we need to do some work. And what I mean by removed from a setting is, I'm sure you guys have seen this, it's made its way on the internet. It's like a funny picture of a text where a mom is asking her kid, or says, "Aunt Sarah died, LOL. And the kid's like, "What's so funny about that?" And the mom said, "It's not funny, it's sad." And they said, "Mom, LOL is laugh out loud." And she said, "Oh, I thought it meant lots of love," right? That's how fast we get out of touch. So imagine, we're going to try and figure out something that was texted in Jesus' time. Right now, I'm going to try and help us. So the setting for the story is a Middle Eastern wedding, and remnants of its customs continued into the more remote Palestinian villages, and that's where we think this is set. And it's a wedding banquet, and banquets in general, when you hear about them in the Bible, in the New Testament, they're a symbol all over the place of the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven. When you hear there's a wedding banquet, think kingdom of heaven, the way it should be intended. And our bridal party is waiting for this late bridegroom at the home. This is how it would have been, and they would have all known this, but I'm telling you, because we don't know this, at the bride's parents' house. Most of the wedding guests wait there too. So they all gather at the bride's parents' house, and it's the responsibility of the bridesmaids to escort the bride to meet the groom once he arrives. And from there, they join a whole long procession that will lead the whole party to the groom's parents' house, and that's where the ceremony is going to take place. Everybody would have known that hearing this. Since traditionally, this will occur over the course of a whole day into an early evening. They would have known that too, but we don't know that. You know, our weddings, although we have these, like, what do they call them? Destination weddings, right? Now that's the thing. But back then, this is how people did it. So since that would have been happening, those bridesmaids would have had lamps with them for the end of the day. And they would be lighting the way for the bride, and then for both of them, the bride and the groom. And the long-awaited bridegroom, that symbol, that always points to the Messiah coming. They're all in wait mode, so when you hear about a bridegroom, you think the Messiah, all right? And the oil lamps probably look like that. And it's fuzzy, it's the best I could do, but that is about this big, okay? And it fits in the palm of your hand. And you just carry it like this. They didn't have iPhones where we can just push our button, but now it's iPhone flashlight is closer to this than a mag light, you know? Although you can't beat the intruder if you don't have a mag light. We have mag lights. My husband is good with the mag light there. Okay. So we've never had an intruder. I digress. So that's the scene. Got it? And Jesus uses all of those familiar components, unfamiliar to us, but familiar to the hearer, to construct this parable. The strange picture of the bridegroom's midnight arrival reflects the idea, then, that the Messiah is going to come in an unexpected manner. There's a phrase in the Bible, like a thief in the night. And five of the bridesmaids he labels as foolish. Why? Because they don't have any extra oil for their lamp. Five of the bridesmaids, he says, are wise. Why? Because they pack extra oil for their lamp. And the cry of the foolish bridesmaids, they say in here, Sarah read it, Lord, Lord. And the sad response once the groom finally shows up, when he says, I don't know you, is meant to remind us of an earlier place in Matthew where it said, not everyone who says to me, and they would have known this story too, Lord, Lord, will get to be in the wedding banquet, the kingdom of heaven. And Christ will return and then turn away those who have made poor choices and say, I never knew you. Door slammed in your face. That is seriously judgmental. It is, let's be honest. But what we want to hold on to is that the people who would have been the earliest hearers of this have been in that wait mode. Remember I said that? And they would have been waiting and waiting for the Messiah. So they would hear this and they'd be thinking, is all this waiting going to ever get me anywhere? Am I in or am I out? Because what they want is to be in. They want to attend that wedding, right? I think that's what they want anyway. At the very end, Jesus says, keep awake. Now that's weird. He tells everyone to keep awake. The trouble is, at least trouble for me, is that none of those bridesmaids, not even the wise ones, actually stayed awake all night. None of them. They all slept. All of them. Wise and foolish together. And when the parable ends by saying keep awake, I'm assuming that's a metaphor because nobody wise or foolish stays awake during this. And that's confusing to me. What is the deal? Wise and foolish both fall asleep. So I'm thinking that the clue is to interpret the parable on the surface is to look at those who were ready then. If it's not about staying awake because they all fall asleep, then I got to go deeper and say, okay, maybe it's about being ready. For what? What are they ready for? I think they're supposed to be ready for the bridegroom. But that can't be either. Because they are. They were there on time. They brought their lamps. Right? Everyone was ready. He was late. I hate that. So, now I'm back to their thinking. Am I in or am I out? What's the reward? Is there no reward, really? The answer has got to be yes. But their wisdom, the wise ones, I'm thinking there's got to be something in being ascribed wise. didn't tell them to wait. The wise ones weren't wise because they were told to wait. The wise ones were distinctive, not because they were ready for the groom, but because they were ready for the groom to be late. They figured that out. Sorry, that's me. To bring along extra oil is a signal that somehow, I think, they were prepared for a bridegroom, whether he was early, whether he was on time, or whether he was late. And our band teacher says, early is on time and on time is late. And my youngest son says, then on time is late. Then late is early. I'll just leave you with that. I could sit down now. But the bridegroom doesn't come on time. We know that, and he's delayed. And here we are, 2,000 or so years later, and maybe he's still late. Maybe he still hasn't come. See, at the beginning of his ministry in the parables of the kingdom, Jesus proclaimed that this mystery of the kingdom coming was already here. Not yet, but already here. It's so confounding. And through parables, he proclaimed that the device by which we're going to figure that out, that mystery, and how it operates, is this device called grace. And it works at its will and at God's will. And Jesus in this is coming full circle and giving us a picture of how faith, maybe he is ultimately triumphing and separating those who accept that faith is a mystery and so is grace, and those who by unfaith reject this freely given grace. The 10 bridesmaids, he says, took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now, let's also be clear, these are like 14-year-olds. How wise can you be? Said the 53-year-old. I am wise. Lillian, you are the wisest. You know, we grow in wisdom, right? We grow in wisdom. So these 10 bridesmaids are 10 to 14 years old at best. So here's what I think they think they're wise about. They got to be bridesmaids. They are so happy to get the dress, right? They're going to be all dressed up, and they get to go to the wedding, and they have cake and cookies in their future, and they absolutely know that. It's going to be a great party. They don't have to worry if they're invited or not. They don't have to worry about a date. That is all they care about. The crisis of their possible non-membership has been solved for them. The danger of their receiving a snub has been taken care of. No one is going to reject them. They see nothing but tea and cakes in their future. Except that 5 of them still get called foolish, and 5 get called wise. What's that about? Maybe it is that there are 2 kinds of wisdom, like I said. Because we really do know some wise 14-year-olds. We do. And unfortunately, sometimes that kind of wisdom comes from knowing too much about the world too soon. And we really do know that there's another kind of wisdom where you're always prepared for everything because your mother and father have raised you that way. Right? So you bring extra oil, you bring extra batteries, you have an extra charger, you have it all. But maybe the wise represent how it is back then to be wise in believing that the Messiah is going to come when the Messiah is going to come. And only that belief and holding loosely to that is going to get them through their lives of oppression and poverty and power imbalance. It said, "For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them." The image is that of a life lived on an ordinary basis, of what's likely going to happen, because for the most part, grooms are on time. So who needs extra oil? It's a picture of happy little people assuming that their luck is always going to hold, and they need to make no extra effort to deal with the implausible. There's a person in my kitchen table who has a brother like that, and she names that her brother's luck, because she's always prepared, and stuff just gets handed to him. But in this case, not so much. Because the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. And I want us to notice how Jesus deliberately stands things upside down there. The five supposedly foolish girls, knowing that they have been invited to this wedding that will only last into the early evening, reasonably assess their needs. I don't think that's a bad thing. They content themselves with just taking what they have. Nothing could be more sensible than that. But the other five insist on dragging along milk cartons full of kerosene, just in case. We all know those different kinds of people. I remember my friend who, my friend Grady, had a friend Jerry. Jerry was not a parent yet. And Jerry and his then wife had their first baby and came to stay with Chris and Grady. And Grady didn't have kids yet. And he came and he said, I mean, he was so distressed. He said, "Holy Mother of God, Linda. Jerry used to come to my house with his briefcase, a pair of boxers, and a toothbrush. That car was packed to the gills, and he forgot his toothbrush." Okay? There are times in our lives when we shift, when we try to prepare for everything. But it's not always what's demanded of us. Why does Jesus make that first group seem wiser than the second? Maybe Jesus doesn't want to preclude our interpreting the oil in the lamps as doing good works in the world while we wait. Because in this way, those foolish girls, they're good people. They're sweet girls who don't obsess about stuff. And in this way, I think maybe for their age, they're quite wise enough, quite sufficiently possessed to be bridesmaids and beautiful at a wedding. And the wise girls, the ones he deems wise, maybe we would actually see them as a bunch of OCD females. Really, preoccupied. Not present in the world, because all they do is worry about what might happen, right? I wonder. But the point of the story, I think, that ultimately I'm willing to say that makes them wise, even if they're a little OCD, is this. If you really live in the world, no matter what the age is, you get to a place in your wisdom when you figure out that in this world, something always goes wrong. Now, I'm not being fatalistic, but happens, right? And so in this parable, I didn't say it. In this parable, Jesus shares that when the bridegroom took his time arriving, they all slumbered and slept, all of them. And the giggles were going on through the whole night. And finally, it gets late, and the wedding feast turns into a slumber party, and they're sacked out, and suddenly they hear a cry. "Behold, the bridegroom, come out and meet him." They're in their PJs. There are, I think, three things to note in that moment, in that verse. First, it's a parable of the course, or maybe two things. It's a parable of the course of the world as it really is. The unexpected really does happen fairly regularly. And the bridegroom's annoyingly delayed arrival is a detail that can be justified only by one fact, that it fits perfectly in a world where stuff is delayed all the time. got into college, got my master's degree. Certainly I'm ready to work in my field. Wow, Starbucks is the only one hiring, really? Dang. Got married, got my money saved. It's time for kids. Infertility, really? Crap. Bought our first house. Ready to really settle down. Certain we have done the right thing to reap the benefits of saving money, building our nest egg. Nothing is as safe and sacred as equity. Housing bubble. In California. Really? Really. Annoyingly late comes the bridegroom. There's a little bit more, and it's kind of dark, because this verse also bears witness to the complicity. And this is going to bother some people. So the complicity of God. Not only in the annoyingly uncertain way the world is run, but in the failures of those who counted on the world being run in a more respectable fashion. God. For those whose fault it is, ultimately, that the otherwise perfectly reasonable and current amount of oil in the foolish girl's lamp runs out. Whose fault is that? It's got to be somebody's fault. The bridegroom's. That's whose fault it is. He was freaking late. And the bridegroom represents who, did I say? The Messiah. So then, whose fault is it? Ultimately, in the Christian story, whose fault is it that Peter ultimately denies Jesus and turns his back on him? Whose fault is it that Judas ultimately betrays Jesus? This would say that it's God's fault. If God had left Peter in the fishing business, Peter would never have gotten into the water. He couldn't navigate. He wouldn't have worried about denying Jesus before the cock crowed because he would have been fishing. If God had left Judas to be the smartest CPA in the county, Judas would never have been tempted by money to run Jesus's career for him and then run him into the ground. In this way, God is not honest. God is not perfect. God is being God. And it's the only God we've got. We're stuck with this kind of God. But if we're stuck with God, that also means, see, God's stuck with us. Why couldn't God have figured out a way of getting rid of sin without creating more sinners in the process? I think that's a reasonable question to ask, personally. I think it's a reasonable thing to wonder. I've yet to come up with an answer, just so you know. I wonder it often. Job in the Old Testament wondered it. His answer was this: though God slays me, yet I'm going to trust. Jesus, his answer was, take this cup from me. I don't want to suffer. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done, O God. Wow. Wow. Well, the parable's not over yet, because next, Jesus does just a little bit more. The judgment that's pronounced on those who thought that history could be brought to a close by something really neat and much more tidy than a mystery, he says this: then all the maidens rose and trimmed their lamps, all of them. See? All of them were getting ready to go. They all take the ordinary, reasonable steps that life in this world dictates that we all take. But in so doing, then they discover something that all the wick trimming in the world, all the brilliant steps that might be taken to make a properly designed operation, like a wedding banquet, run right, all of that is irrelevant. Because the operation is not properly designed. Because the bridegroom's late for his own party. God's taken so long to do anything that the world has dug its own grave while we wait. World War I, World War II, Korean War, Twin Towers. It goes on and on and on. Unless there is something other than the wisdom of the world to help it, there is nothing for the world to do but to lie down and die. That's kind of where this seems to be headed. It's that something, therefore, that becomes the only matter of judgment in this parable. That's where it gets to at the end. And now all of the girls are on the edge of that place, wise and foolish, and they've found out there's no way of going on from here simply by moving forward. They can't all get in. And the criteria is faith. And the foolish say to the wise, "How about you give us some of yours, your oil? How about you give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out?" But the wise reply, "Perhaps there will not be enough for us and for you. Go rather to the dealers and buy it for yourselves." I call that a no. Have you ever tried to give someone your faith? Have you ever tried to give someone your faith? You can set up everything you want. You can bring them to godly play. You can sit in church. But can you make a person have faith? There comes a time when you have it or you don't. And this parable, as harsh as it sounds, tells us that sometimes time runs out. And that's real life. And since faith is something we practice in real life, it would seem that this parable is saying the time for faith for some of these people has run out. Not for everyone, but for some. And the parable does seem to say that since faith is a relationship with God, there will inevitably be a point at which God is going to present us in a moment with a yes or no question. At that point, whenever that happens for you, I'm just going to suggest that a maybe might be unadvisable. I'm not saying that it's wrong. But really think about your maybe. What are you waiting for? Now, maybe the wise maidens, you know, maybe they're just snotty. I'm not sharing. There's that possibility. You're going to have to decide that. Also, when they say, those wise maidens, go and buy some oil, they know perfectly well it's the Sabbath and all the shops are closed. So what seems like, oh, just go buy some for yourself, they know that's not possible. So I'm just saying. So maybe this is the point of the parable, and I'm close to done here. Someday, later soon, it's going to be too late even for any of us to believe. And we become what we practice. So if we trust, we become trusters, okay? And if we're in a relationship, we become relationship people. If we distrust, we become distrustful people and close out relationships around us. And that closure is where this parable ends. Because it's while they went to buy, they went ahead, the bridegroom came. And those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. And afterwards, the other maidens came back after a fruitless shopping trip and said, "Lord, Lord, open to us." And he replied, Amen, I say to you, I don't know you. I don't know you. So the shut door, maybe, is God's final answer to the foolish wisdom of the world, which says things are always going to go right with me and for me, and I will always somehow be able to figure this out by myself. I'm going to be fine. I don't need extra oil. But all those bright, savvy types who thought they had it figured out are outside in the dark, with no oil and no party. And that really harsh sentence, amen, I say to you, I never knew you, is really just simply not in this way a rejection, but it's just a statement. I never knew you. I thought I knew you, but I didn't really know you. Because see, maybe Jesus could have put another line in there. Because he doesn't say, I never loved you. He doesn't say, I never drew myself close to you. Does he? He just says, I never knew you. Because you never really bothered to know me. See? So, the wedding banquet begins with the parable of the wise and foolish bridesmaids and ends with this. Watch, therefore, for you neither know the day nor the hour. So that when all is said and done, when we have scared ourselves silly, because this is kind of scary, I confess, I know that. When we scare ourselves with the now or never urgency that is faith and the once and always finality of judgment, we need to take a deep breath. Okay? But then, like yoga, just relax. Just let the breath back out. Because you're here. You're here. And you're watching for the party. Right? You're watching for your invitation. And the party's not just down the street with other people. And here's some really good news, I think. The party is already gathering steam and kitchen tables. Right? Those are our small groups. I get like this, just ignore it. And the uncertain day and hour of it's finally bursting into the hallway and making its way through our whole houses. It's not dreadful and scary. It may feel that way, but it's grace. And it's coming for all of us. So some of us have taken Blueprint in our group, and we ask this question of everyone, where are you in the house? Just maybe that makes a little more sense with this parable. Where are you in the house? And what is your moment of saying yes? Or do you keep saying maybe? And we're all in it together. So, maybe a way to hear this is that the wise ones are those who are prepared for a delay. That's the only wisdom anyone can ever really have. That things don't always happen the way we think they're going to happen. And they are those who hold on to faith deep into the night. Who, even though they see no bridegroom coming, they're still hoping. And it is still true that many of us will feel despairing and turn away. And be filled with discouragement because we've done the best that we can. And we'll say the bridegroom has left us standing at the altar. Because sometimes it feels that way. This banquet, forget it, it's off. There is no kingdom of God. There is no kingdom of heaven. Life is just one cursed thing after another with no goal and no end in sight. But then in the middle of the night, when we least expect it, there's this sound. It says, look, The bridegroom's coming. At last, thank God. I don't know when that moment is for you. I really don't. But I have faith that we are in it together. We really are. If we want to be, that's our choice.
By the grace of the Lord, I've come a long way. By the grace of the Lord, I've come a long way. He's been my bread when I was hungry. He's been my company keeper every time I get a little lonely. By the grace of the Lord, I've come a